All right, the Gettysburg Address is one of my favorite speeches of all time, and we're so happy tonight to have Al Smith come down all the way from the Boston area, along with Nadine, to talk about that speech. Al's lecture on the Gettysburg Address will give you some new perspectives on probably the most famous speech ever written in this country's history.
I hope.
All right, Al has been a Civil War enthusiast for over 40 years. An inspiration of all the Civil War work that he's done has been a fundamental force for much of the avocational study of the Civil War that takes place in Massachusetts today. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree in accounting from Bentley College. He's a member of many Civil War roundtables in the greater Boston area, camps, and a member of our Bull Run Civil War roundtable, as he's wearing his badge tonight, which we all are, so so that's great. Al's other focus is philanthropy for protection of animals and volunteers to visit and assist those who are in care of hospice services. Let's give a big round of applause for Mr. Al Smith.
Nothing to hook you up with.
Thank you very, very much.
Would you mind if I take my jacket off?
No.
I'm from Boston, and we left cold weather, and I'm not used to this heat wave, and looking outside at the cherry blossoms saying, there isn't one tree in Boston that even has a bud on it. So this is a heat wave to me.
It came a couple of weeks earlier.
I know. So if you mind, I'll take my coat off and let's get relaxed. When I first began to think of the topic I wanted to speak about to this group, I thought I would like to talk about the 1938 reunion at Gettysburg. That particular talk was developed for me some 40 plus years ago, when even till today, the most exciting thing that ever happened to me in my Civil War life. That I met a man who attended the 1938 reunion who actually talked to a Civil War soldier. And then through my entire Civil War life, I have thought that is the greatest thing that has ever happened to me, that I met a man who talked to a Civil War soldier. And with that, I wanted to remember him by developing a talk. Well, I developed one and it looked pretty good on paper till about, a couple of months ago. I was able to obtain some marvelous, just absolutely marvelous memorabilia from the 1938 and 1913 reunion at Gettysburg. So now that I am in possession of such material, I've decided to change that talk. So I'm going to redevelop the 1938 reunion to now to include the 13 reunion with the 38 reunion and come back with another talk. So that if you folks like my talk tonight about the Gettysburg Address, maybe you'll invite me again next year to come back and we'll talk about the 38 reunion.
Oh, maybe.
Okay, would you like that? I don't mind driving all the way from Boston down to here with my co-pilot Nadine. It's a cinch. So if you like what I have to say tonight, then I would be most happy to come back again next year. So for tonight's talk, some of the references that I used to develop the talk were the 7 versions of the Gettysburg Address, but in reality there's only 5. The Perfect Tribute, which contains a lot of falsehoods about the Gettysburg Address. Gary Will's issue of the Gettysburg Address. And most recently, one by Martin Johnson about writing the Gettysburg Address. So I would like to begin tonight's talk by putting out to you some of the possible falsehoods and possible truths about the Gettysburg Address. And you can make up your own mind, and hopefully you'll come to an agreement the way I have about some of the falsehoods. So I'll begin. The myth that Lincoln jotted his brief remarks on the back of an envelope is false. Better attested reports have him considering them on the way to the photographer's shop in Washington. That's false. Writing them on a piece of cardboard as the train took him to Gettysburg. That, too, is false. Penciling them in at the David Wills house on the night before the dedication? Possible. Even composing them in the head of as Everett spoke? That's false. There are mythical accounts of which badly put Lincoln out of character. Who composed his speeches thoroughly? His law partner, William Herndon, had years of experience watching Lincoln record his speeches slowly, sort out his points, and tighten his logic and phrasing. The myth that Lincoln was disappointed as a result of the Gettysburg Address, as he told Ward Lamon, that he used the term, his speech was like a bad plow, it won't scour, has no basis. According to historian Gary Wills, this statement has no basis of fact and largely originates from unreliable recollection of Lamon. He had done what he wanted to do. That's exactly what Mr. Lincoln came to do. That's what Mr. Lincoln accomplished. You have to keep in mind, Abraham Lincoln was a very methodical person. He thought of his thoughts, he put them together, and then he came together with his speech. Remember, growing up as children, we learned that Abraham Lincoln was a person who used to put little notes in his top hat. That's the truth about Abraham Lincoln. He would put his little notes in his hat, and then later on pull them out and sort them out, put them in order, just like people do today with their computers. They put little notes on their PowerPoint presentations, a little note here, a little note there, and then they put the sentences together. That's the true Abraham Lincoln. He did not pencil in last moment. He did not think of something at the very end. He possibly could have put some final notes on the speech the night before when he was staying at the Gary Wills house. So what I would like to read to you right now is the one version of the five known versions of the Gettysburg Address. The reason why this one is considered the most accurate, the one version that really had meaning and was read by Abraham Lincoln, is because he signed it. The other four versions were not signed. So because of the fact that he signed this particular version, it is considered the one version that was used at the reading of the Gettysburg Address. Keeping in mind, when Abraham Lincoln read the Gettysburg Address, he did not read from that paper. He held the speech in his hand, and he read the 272 words from his mind. He had them memorized already. So let me read to you the one version that is considered the most accurate. I pray that I give it justice. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we're engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those here who gave their lives that this nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or to detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. One little tidbit of FYI. Of all the movies and TV programs that you've seen about Abraham Lincoln, you've always seen these actors
with deep voices and their bellowing words.
Abraham Lincoln did not talk that way. Abraham Lincoln talked as a Kentuckian. He had a very high-pitched voice, almost to the point of being almost falsetto. But that was the true Abraham Lincoln voice. It was not this deep, bellowing, robust voice. The one actor that did kind of copy it pretty well was Daniel Day-Lewis in the movie Lincoln. If anybody, I hope some you saw this movie, because it was an excellent movie. It only had one or two things that were maybe not so right, but 99.99% accurate. Especially Daniel Day-Lewis's version of Abraham Lincoln, and he looked like him too. The Gettysburg Address is a speech by President Lincoln, considered one of the best known in American history. It was delivered by Lincoln during the Civil War on the afternoon of Thursday, November 19th of 1863. At the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, 4.5 months after the Union armies defeated those of the Confederacy at the Battle of Gettysburg. I apologize. Lincoln's carefully crafted address, secondary to other presentations that day, came to be regarded as one of the greatest speeches in American history. In just over 2 minutes, Lincoln reiterated the principles of human equality espoused by the Declaration of Independence and proclaimed the Civil War as a struggle for the preservation of the Union separated by the secession crisis, with a new birth of freedom that would bring true equality to all of us citizens, ensuring that democracy would remain a viable form of government and creating a nation in which states' rights were no longer dominant. Lincoln also redefined the Civil War as a struggle not just for the Union, but also for the principle of human equality. Abraham Lincoln has been one of the few people in all of our American history that has held such an effect on all of us with the spoken word. In the words of Walt Whitman, famous author and poet, Abraham Lincoln was really one of those characters, the best of which is the result of long trains of thought and effect needing a certain spaciousness of time and perhaps even remoteness to properly enclose them, having unequaled influence on the shaping of this republic and therefore the world as today, and then far more important in the future. Thus, the time has by no means yet come for a thorough measurement of him. Nevertheless, we live in an era who have seen him, who have heard him, face to face, and in the midst of and just parting from the strong and strange events for which we've had to do, with we can have some respect bear valuable. Perhaps indispensable testimony concerning him, it was thought that I now tell you the story about Abraham Lincoln and the effect that he has had on America when some of the most heartfelt and long-remembered words were ever spoken. In the aftermath of the Battle of Gettysburg, both sides leaving some 50,000 dead, wounded, or missing behind them, the residents of Gettysburg had little reason to be satisfied with the war machine that had chummed up their lives. through all the missed chances, the senseless deaths, missed opportunities, would give rise to a symbol of national purpose, pride, and ideals. Abraham Lincoln transformed the ugly reality into something rich and strange, and he did it with 272 words. The power of words has really been given a more compelling demonstration. Keeping in mind, I'm sure some of you already know, and I feel honored for those of you who are aware of the setting of the Gettysburg Address, I feel honored that you know this. And for those of you who do not know about the setting of the Gettysburg Address, I am honored that hopefully you will learn from what I say. The setting of the Gettysburg Address was done some 4 months after the battle. The dead were still on the battlefield. The dead horses were still on the battlefield. The guns were still being found on the battlefield. It was not a pretty sight. It was a terrible sight. And especially the smell. That's the atmosphere that Abraham Lincoln used to give the Gettysburg Address. The village leaders decided that it was necessary to have a consecration of the National Cemetery. Pennsylvania Governor Curtin would ask David Wills, a local Gettysburg attorney, to organize the plans to put into action the dedication of such a cemetery. Wills felt the need for an artful words to sweeten the poisoned air of Gettysburg. Wills will ask the notable poets of his time, Longfellow, Whittier, and Bryant, to join the effort. But sadly, for whatever reason, they said no to this invitation. Not deterred by this refusal, and knowing this kind of patriotic demonstration would have a great power over any audience, he put his efforts into obtaining the abilities of Everett Everett, considered to be the champion of speech-making. Everett Everett was a rare person, a scholar and a diplomat, who could enthrall any mass audience. His voice, diction, and gestures were successfully dramatic, and he performed his well-crafted text, no matter how long, all of them from memory. Everett was a prime choice for Wills. Battlefields was something of a specialty for Mr. Everett. He had augmented the fame of Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill by his oratory at the Revolutionary War sites. Simply to have him speak would add Gettysburg to the sacred rolls of names from the founders' battles. Will's speech was over 2 hours long. There's another effort. I'm sorry, Everett Everett. I apologize. Everett Everett's speech was over 2 hours long. It was 13,600 words long, all from memory. I don't want to brag, but he was also from Massachusetts. The importance of inviting federal participation in a state activity was not a major faux pas for the 19th century. President Lincoln was not offended. A solemn ceremony was organized to dedicate the cemetery, and President Lincoln was invited to attend and give a few appropriate remarks. There was only one oration announced or desired here. Lincoln's contribution was labeled as remarks, and it was intended to make his dedication formal, like a ribbon cutting, and Lincoln was not expected to talk at length. Lincoln knew the power of his rhetoric to define his war aims. He was seeking this occasion to use his words outside the normal round of proclamation and reports to Congress. He knew that most of the state governors would be attending or would be sending important aides, and that the ceremony would also include a large crowd. This was a classic situation for fence mending and intelligence gathering Lincoln would take with him to his aides and who would circulate and bring back their findings. Edward Stanton would make the arrangements for the trip, but Lincoln was not wanting to leave anything to chance, countermanded Stanton's plans, and he would say, "I do not like this arrangement. I do not wish to wish to so go that by the slightest accident we entirely and will best the whole be a mere breathless running of the gauntlet." If Lincoln had not changed his schedule, he would not likely have given his speech. The trip from Washington to Gettysburg was some 120 miles, and travel time would be very, very hard. The honor of being the main speaker was given to Edward Everett, who responded with a poetic two-hour speech. His talk was the kind of speech that would be expected for such an occasion. Everett Everett was a great American statesman and orator from Massachusetts, and would later write to Mr. Lincoln, "I should be glad that I could flatter myself that I came to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes." The relationship between President Lincoln and Edward Everett was not exactly the greatest. They kind of didn't like each other, but they were respectful of each other. After that letter, that note from Edward Everett saying, "You accomplished more in 272 words than I did in 2 hours," the wounds were healed, and now he became, you know, much friendlier to Mr. Edward. It is worthy to note of the strong feelings that Massachusetts had for Mr. Lincoln and the Civil War, as exhibited by the words of Charles Sumner and Edward Everett. On June 1st of 1865, Senator Sumner commented on what is now considered the most famous speech by President Lincoln. In his eulogy on the slain president, he called it a monumental act. He said that Lincoln was mistaken that the world will little note nor long remember what we say here. Rather, the Bostonian said, the world noted at once what was said and will never cease to remember it. The battle itself was less important than the speech. It is worthy to note that the strong feelings that Massachusetts has had for Mr. Lincoln and the Civil War is exhibited by the words of Charles Sumner and Edward Everett. The words spoken at Gettysburg are some of the most beautiful words ever spoken, but also offered the most elegant tribute to the soldier heroes who died so that the nation might live. But it also told America that it must now be dedicated to a new birth of freedom that would guarantee equality and justice for all. Mr. Lincoln believed this freedom was worth fighting for and even to die for. Abraham Lincoln must be credited with not only writing the poetry of the Gettysburg Address, but also the legality of the Emancipation Proclamation. These two documents will stand for all time in our American history. A review of certain phrases in the Gettysburg Address will explain why Mr. Lincoln used them. In order to accomplish that purpose, it is important to enter into the mind of Mr. Lincoln when he composed the Gettysburg Address. Mr. Lincoln's mindset was he not only wanted to make a political statement, but he wanted to make known of his belief in the equality of all men. The victory of Gettysburg was a positive political store of victory toward emancipation, but it also absolved him from any Northern opposition towards the war. The sadness of the event left questions in his heart as to how many more men had to die in order to protect the living. And perhaps of his thought, he wanted his thoughts to be spoken in just the right way. His message had to be that the soldiers did not die in vain, that they knew what they were fighting for, and that the soldiers' efforts had to be commemorated. He knew that he wanted to say, but he put pen to paper, he still didn't have it right. Lincoln gets his inspiration from the men who fought, and he does not want to fail them and would rely on the direct source of beliefs, the Declaration of Independence. I quote from the opening lines of both the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address that shows that both documents possess the same inspiration. The Declaration of Independence opens with, "When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled. A decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Several theories have been advanced by Lincoln, scholars attempt to explain the provenance of Lincoln's famous phrase, "Government of the people, by the people, for the people." In a discussion, more probable origin of a Lincoln phrase published in the American Monthly Review of Reviews, Albert Shaw credits a correspondence with pointing the writings of William Herndon, Lincoln's law partner, who wrote in his 1888 work, Abraham Lincoln, the true story of a great life, that he had brought to Lincoln some of the sermons of abolitionist minister Theodore Parker of Massachusetts. You're gonna love Massachusetts. I'm speaking to back. Would you guys like to take a trip to Boston? Bring your folks up. We'll show you a great Civil War trip. You go down to Chantilly, you go down to Chattanooga, all these places. Come to Boston. We'll show you a great Civil War tour. As evident, Janet will vouch, you were there. You received a great tour of Boston and Civil War. She never saw so many grave sites, so many cemeteries. She loves them. She found more generals in Boston than anywhere else. Okay? Come to Boston, we'll show you a great time. And I promise you, the food will be great. You'll have real fish. Not this stuff down.
When we go to Boston, you get scrod, right?
No scrod, haddock. You get haddock, the real thing. And lobster. Lobster. You get lobster. So come on to Boston. We'll show you a great time. Mark's coming.
I'll try to make it.
Albert Shaw credits a correspondent with pointing the writings of William Herndon, Theodore Parker of Massachusetts, and that Lincoln was moved by Parker's use of this idea. I brought with me additional sermons and lectures of Theodore Parker, who was warm in his commendations of Lincoln. One of these was a lecture on the effects of slavery on the people, and which I gave to Lincoln, who read it and returned it. He was liked especially the following expression, which he marked with a pencil, for which he is substance afterwards used in his Gettysburg Address. Democracy is a direct government of over all the people, for the people, by the people. Craig R. Smith, in his criticism of political rhetoric and disciplinary integrity, suggested Lincoln's view of the government, as expressed in the Gettysburg Address, was influenced by the noted speech of Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster, the second reply to Hayne, in which Webster famously thundered, "Liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable." Specifically, in this January 26, 1830 speech before the United States Senate, Webster described the federal government as made for the people, made by the people, and answerable to the people. Webster also noted, "The government, sir, is an independent offspring of the popular will. It is not the creature of state legislators. Nay, more, if the whole truth must be told, the people brought it into existence, established it, and have hitherto supported it for the very purpose, amongst others, of imposing certain salutary restraints on state sovereignties." A source predating these others, with which Lincoln was certainly familiar with, was Chief Justice John Marshall, in his opinion in McCulloch versus Maryland of 1819, a case asserting federal authority to create a national bank and to be free from the state's powers to tax. In asserting the superiority of federal power over the states, Chief Justice Marshall stated, "The government of the people, then, whatever may be the influence of this fact on this case, is emphatically and truly a government of the people. In form and in substance, it emanates from them, its powers are granted by them, and they are exercised directly on them and for their benefit." Lincoln, a lawyer and president, engaged in the greatest struggle of federalism, and was more eloquently echoing the preeminent case that had solidified federal power over the states. Gary Wills observed Lincoln's usage of this imaginary of birth, life, and death in the reference to the nations brought forth, conceived, and shall not perish. Others, including Alan C. Gelzo, the director of Civil War era studies of Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania, suggested that Lincoln's formulation, 77, was an allusion of the King James Version of the Bible, Psalms 90-10, for which man's lifespan is given as 70 years, and by reason of strength, they be 80 years. The opening lines of the Gettysburg Address, the same thoughts and desires of the Declaration of Independence. 77 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. This is just one of the passages of the Gettysburg Address that allowed Mr. Lincoln to derive the power of his message. Lincoln examined the founding principles of the United States in the context of the Civil War and memorialized the sacrifices of those who gave their lives at Gettysburg and extolled virtues for the listeners and the nation to ensure the survival of America's representative democracy. The government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. The Gettysburg Address has become the authoritative expression of the American spirit with the same authority as the Declaration of Independence. During the train trip from Washington, D.C. to Gettysburg on November 18th, Lincoln remarked to John Hay that he felt weak. On the morning of November 19th, Lincoln mentioned to John Nicolay that he was dizzy. In the railroad car, the president rode with his secretary, John G. Nicolay, and his assistant secretary, John Hay, also accompanied him with three members of his cabinet, William Seward, John Usher, and Montgomery Blair. Several foreign officials and others, Hay noted that during the speech, Lincoln's face had become ghastly color and that he was sad, mournful, almost haggard. After the speech, when Lincoln boarded the 6:30 p.m. train for Washington, D.C., he was feverish and weak with a severe headache, and a lengthy illness would follow, which included a severe rash and was diagnosed as a mild case of smallpox. The conclusion that can be derived is that Lincoln, from the beginning stages of smallpox when he delivered the Gettysburg Address. Despite the historical significance of Lincoln's speech, modern scholars disagree as to its exact wording, and contemporary transcriptions published in the newspaper accounts of the events and even handwritten copies of Lincoln himself in their wording, punctuation, and structure. Of those versions, the Bliss version, written well after the speech as a favor for a friend, is viewed as many as the standard text. Its text differs, however, from the written versions prepared by Lincoln before and after the speech. It is the only version in which Lincoln affixed his signature and the last he is known to have written. The five known manuscript copies of the Gettysburg Address are named for the associated persons who received them from Lincoln. Lincoln gave a copy to each of his private secretaries, John Hay and John Nicolay, and both of these drafts were written around the same time of his November 19th address. While the other three copies of the address, the Edward Everett, also known as the Everett Keyes copy, the George Bancroft copy, and the Alexander Bliss, were written by Lincoln for charitable purposes well after November 19th. The two earliest drafts of the address are associated with some confusion and controversy regarding the existence and provenance. That's why I pointed out in this copy there are seven supposed versions, but there are only five authenticated versions of the Gettysburg Address. Two were written by newspaper people.
And we all know how shifty they are.
Yes. No, you got me going. I lost my place. Regarding the existence of provenance, Nicolay and Hay were appointed custodians of Lincoln's papers by Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln, in 1874. After appearing in a facsimile in an article written by John Nicolay in 1894, the Nicolay copy was presumably among the papers passed to John Hay by Nicolay's daughter, Helen, upon Nicolay's death in 1901. Robert Lincoln began a search for the original in 1908, which resulted in the discovery of a handwritten copy of the Gettysburg Address among the bound papers of John Hay, a copy now known as the Hay copy or the Hay draft. The Hay draft differed from the version of the Gettysburg Address published by John Nicolay in 1894 in a number of significant ways. It was written on a different type of paper, had a number of words, and the number of lines contained editorial revisions in Lincoln's hand. I have, with the assistance of my computer whiz, Nadine, to complete the talk. In 1938, along with the reunion, which next year I'll talk about, hopefully, there was an interview granted by a fellow by the name of William Rathbone to NPR, National Public Radio. No TV back then, I would have loved to have seen it. In which he described his life as a young lad on November the 19th of 1863. He is the last known witness to the Gettysburg Address. And I would like to play you a short excerpt of that interview from 1938. And if with anybody luck, Nadine will be able to.
For President's Day, we present a treasure unearthed in our quest for sound. That's a special project that allows you to participate in our year-long series, Lost and Found Sound. They will give you the telephone number to call to make your contribution. We're asking you to dig through your attics and bookshelves for your old, precious recordings, and to call us at our quest hotline and subscribe them to us. Hundreds of you have already called our curator of the quest, independent producer, Jay Allison.
Among the remarkable collection of voicemail messages telling us about everything from wartime love letters to recorded brawls to the first words of an autistic child, one call intrigued us particularly for broadcast on this day. It came from Claudia Siebold in Palatine, Illinois. She told us she had a recording of her husband's ancestor who, well, this is what she said.
What I have is, I won't even be a casual item, it is a record of a gentleman who I was the eyewitness that Hood Lincoln did the Gettysburg Address.
That's right. The recorded voice of a man who actually heard Abraham Lincoln deliver the Gettysburg Address. We called Mrs. Siebold and retrieved the recording of William V. Rathbone's voice, originally cut in 78 RPM disc in 1938. Our quest for sound team has checked with a number of experts and historians, and they believe it is plausibly genuine. We called the Civil War Institute in Gettysburg. Though they have never heard of this recording, they very much want a copy. We'll send them one right after you hear it.
Because as a schoolboy, I was in the little town of Gettysburg in Pennsylvania some 75 years ago. I am privileged to tell you today what I then heard and saw when Abraham Lincoln, the wartime President of the United States, delivered his immortal address at the dedication of the National Cemetery. When it was known that on a certain day in November, 4 months after the battle, the President Lincoln, old Abe as we boys affectionately called him, was to be in Gettysburg, I was excused from my duties at school and the company of my family, at least to see the President and perhaps to hear what he had to say. Bright and early the next morning, I was in the center square of the town where the procession was to form for the cemetery hill, where the speaking was to take place. At the head of the procession, preceded by a mounted military band, the first I had ever seen, rode the President. He was mounted on a gray horse of medium size, which accentuated his unusual height, his long legs reaching too near the ground, forming a bracer of good horsemanship. The President was escorted to the cemetery by many distinguished officers of the Army, representatives of foreign countries, military and civic organizations, and the surging crowds of patriotic citizens estimated at 20,000. After the long eloquent oration of Honorable Edward Evers of Massachusetts, conceded to be the most finished orator of his day, Lincoln rose and with a manner serious, almost to sadness, gave his brief address that rang from the hills of Gettysburg around the world and back many times and will ever continue to reverberate tenderness and strength on our church. During its delivery, with one or two other lads, I had worked my way under the platform and wheeled through the crowd in front until I stood within 15 feet of Mr. Lincoln and looked up into his serious face. A rough board platform 4 or 5 feet high had been built from which the president spoke. Across the front, over the rail behind which he stood, was draped the nation's flag, the Stars and Stripes. Old Glory, as the soldiers gallantly called it. Although I listened intently to every word the president uttered and heard it clearly, more like I could not recall any of it afterwards, but as any of my companions spoke slightingly of it, there would have been a junior battle of Gettysburg then and there. For any hint or information that old age, as we affectionately called him, was deficient or delinquent in any respect, would have been ascribed. So deep-seated was our youthful loyalty. Perhaps no address of equal length has been more widely published and translated into more languages than the one I heard given by President Lincoln on that November day, 75 years ago. It will bear repetition even now, after more than 80 years and 10 have passed. It needs no eloquence, or I could not attempt to read it to you. Before we can say, 470 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who gave their lives that the nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a lesser sense, larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot harrow this ground. Brave men, living and dead, who struggle here, have consecrated this power above our own power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, and others have been dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have the scars so nobly about. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here, highly resolved that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth.
That was William Rathbaugh, eyewitness to the Gettysburg Address, as recorded in 1938. His words came to us through our Quest for Sound. If you have personal audio treasures you'd like to share with us this year, please call our curator of the Quest, Jay Allison, at 202-408-0400. Again, that's 202-408-0400.
And we send a donation.
So there, ladies and gentlemen, is my presentation of the thoughts and the ideas of the Gettysburg Address. If there's any questions I might be able to answer for you folks, sir?
On the, at the Lincoln Memorial, they have the Lincoln, or the Gettysburg Address carved on one side.
Right.
Which version is it?
I believe that would be the Bliss copy.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, it is too. Anyone else? Sir?
Has there been a comment by President Jefferson Davis on the President Lincoln's address?
No. No, there isn't. They didn't speak. They didn't comment. As far as Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln, they were two different worlds.
No, but has there been any comment by him, good or bad, or whatever?
No.
What was we don't know Jefferson's reaction to the Gettysburg Address.
You have to keep in mind, Southern people of Civil War period did not speak, did not enter any thought-provoking conversations about Northern ideas. They were strictly, everything was involved the South. They didn't get involved with anything Northern.
Well, that's not true. I mean, they tried to influence the 1864 election in many ways.
They didn't talk of it, is what I'm saying. The common person did not talk about Abraham Lincoln. Yes, was there collusion to try to change the election? Was there collusion to try to, you know, win the war through spy, you know, the spy network? Sure. But as far as the common person speaking about Abraham Lincoln, no. And neither did the politicians. They kept away from it. He didn't exist. Sir in the back?
Yes, sir. Do you have a sense of how large the audience for the Gettysburg Address was?
They claim 20,000 people.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
But of 20,000 people, I'm willing to bet you not more than maybe 100 people actually heard him speak. I mean, there was no microphones back then. There was no audio system, well, like you almost had here.
Yeah, like you almost had.
So,
a speech like that was a happening. You didn't have to hear it. You were at the happening. Yeah.
You were at the happening. And besides, knowing Abraham Lincoln's voice, not too many people would have heard it. Question? Gwen?
I don't have a question, but I just thought it was so interesting that you brought out that he wasn't feeling well going up to Gettysburg.
As a matter of fact, he said to his butler that if he could go back and all the people that seek things from him, positions and patronage, he finally had something he could give them in return.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you read about Abraham Lincoln and all the little funny stories he could tell, the first thing I thought of is now that David Letterman is leaving. What a wonderful replacement Abraham Lincoln would have made for David Letterman. I'm telling you, he had more funny stories than you could. I mean, more than a book full. It was really great. Sir, in the blue?
I just think there's a bit of irony comparing the Gettysburg Address to the Declaration of Independence, because the Declaration of Independence is a paean of praise to separation. Gettysburg Address is a paean of praise to unity. So actually, in fact, the South would have hearkened to the Declaration of Independence saying, we have our rights to separate.
But also the basis of the Declaration of Independence, besides being it was equality of people, that the Americans were equal to the British.
And wanted to separate and have their own...
in their own country.
...decision, which, of course, what our colleagues in the South were saying. So there's a certain... making the comparison is, I think, a bit strained, given its nature.
Well, when you talk about secession, my opinion, and, you know, take it for what it's worth, to belong to the United States of America, you belong under the laws of the Constitution. And if you're willing to accept the laws of the Constitution, then you become a member of the United States. And to all of a sudden say, I don't like your ideas, I want to drop out, is contrary to the Constitution. And that's what happened. The state seceded and the government said, we're going to bring you back in.
On that point, it does seem to me that Lincoln was very fond of the Declaration of Independence, but less fond of the U.S. Constitution. He certainly abused a lot of the points of the Constitution during the war, revoking habeas corpus, arresting the Maryland House of Delegates. He did a number of things that kind of cut corners. So I understand on one hand he does like the Declaration of Independence, but he did kind of shave on the U.S. Constitution, and I think some people...
Lincoln's use of his powers was based upon him being a military governor. as a military leader, he had the right to do certain things under military law. He was a firm believer in the Constitution. He was a firm believer in the Declaration of Independence. He did not violate the Constitution. He abided by the Constitution, but he enforced his rules, or the rules of habeas corpus and such, as a military governor. And that's what he used.
Where's the Congress?
Well, actually, it was the Congress that has the right to suspend habeas corpus. It's in Article 1, not in the president's power. And when he did do that, he later recanted, and then Congress passed one after the fact to legitimize that. But his right, it was not for the executive branch to do. That was for the legislative branch to do.
Sir, in the blue?
Yes, sir. I read somewhere that Lincoln's son was also very sick at this time.
Willie was very sick.
And Mary really didn't want him to...
Well, Willie was suffering from bronchitis or pneumonia, and she did not want Mr. Lincoln to go to Gettysburg, but Lincoln felt he had to go, and that's why he went. He was forced to go. Sir?
Was the Gettysburg Address the first time that a president had spoken to dedicate a national cemetery?
Yeah, that's the first one. That would have been the first one. That would have been the first one. Sir?
I had heard a story that David Wills, who was the Republican governor of Pennsylvania, Stanton did not get along. They were political rivals. And that when Lincoln appointed Stanton to be ambassador to England, getting him out of the country, that the governor of Pennsylvania put some pressure that Lincoln would get invited to speak at Gettysburg. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
I haven't heard of that.
I don't know if Stanton leaving his position as Secretary of War during the war.
No. Charles Francis Adams was the ambassador.
Yeah. And Stanton and Lincoln were very good friends. Lincoln had tremendous respect for Mr. Stanton, even though they claim he didn't get along. So I want to extend one more invitation to you. You know, us northern folks, we just love you southern folks, and we want you to join in with us. My roundtable, the Greater Boston Roundtable, is coming down south again for the 43rd or 4th time. And we're going to be visiting Appomattox in May. Appomattox is next year. Spotsylvania is this year. I'm sorry, I apologize. We're going to visit Spotsylvania. I graciously and hopefully extend an invitation to any one of you to come visit us when we come to visit the battlefield of Spotsylvania.
Tell us what it's going to be.
May 17th.
On my
day? No, you don't have to come down all 4 days. Just, one day. Come for supper.
Bring in lobster?
No. Now, lobster is back in my neck of the woods. Because if we brought lobster down, it wouldn't last.
Just don't bring Deval Patrick.
No, we don't want it. In fact, we don't want even Mitt Romney to come either.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank compass you. So you won't lose your way in a little something.
No, I got Nadine. I got Nadine. With her GPS. So thank much. You very much. Right. And I hope to come back again.
Amen. Amen. All right.
Thanks for coming. We'll see you next month for the big 23rd anniversary.
I grew up in Dorchester and graduated from Brookline High School.
In Brookline is the creating of